Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Shank of katelovingshank.com, prayerprescriptions.com, and the author of the upcoming book, Prayer Prescriptions, Spiritual Remedies for Long-Lasting Health. My guest today is Kevin Bien, author of Your Dog is Your Mirror, and also Natural Dog Training. Kevin's series on dog obedience is very enlightening. In order to be successful with our dogs, we have to be more like them. The call-in number is 347-205-9200. Joining me now is Kevin Bien. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great. There's a lot in this book.
there's a lot of moving parts, that's for sure.
I don't know how you brought it all together, but it's brilliant. And I was interested, I want to talk a little bit about your dad. You know, he's a very colorful, or was a very colorful character.
Oh, yeah, he was.
Oh, my gosh. And I guess I can't even imagine, you know, how what it must have been like living. There's a ghost in the machine here. Sorry. I can't imagine what it was like living with such a strong-willed person. But I just want to tell the listening audience that your dad wrote the book Dogs of War. And if you want to just give us a little history on his amazing, celebrity status that came out of that.
Yeah, he was possibly the first family dog trainer, at least in the Northeast, if not America. And right after World War II, he had been training, finagled his way into the Army Canine Corps and trained dogs for deployment, mostly for the Pacific Theater. And they were so successful that he was a guest on a national radio show celebrating those who had made the war effort successful. And on the panel was Robert Oppenheimer of the Manhattan Project atomic bomb experiments and in a final dropping of the bomb. So my father thought, wow, who's going to want to talk to him? But virtually every question from the audience was asked of my father, how do you get your dog to do this? Why do dogs do that? Why do they do this? And he realized from that show that he could make a living doing what he loved to do, which was dog training. So the other thing of note was he was probably the first trainer to see the connection between the wolf and man. And while I came to take fundamental separation as how I saw it, the connection is verified by every scientific essay that, and my father's theory was that the domestic relationship between man and dog was predicated on the social relationship between wolves. So he could have been the very first one to say you have to be the alpha figure, the pack leader. And so he built his business on that. He had an amazingly commanding personality. He was very articulate, great public speaker. And so the best and the brightest of his era beat a path to our farm in Connecticut.
Yeah, he had a love of dogs. And it seems to me as if you took it to another level. And it seems to me that maybe you didn't agree with some of the stuff, some of the theories that your father had.
Yeah, well, I went into it in great depth because the conflict that I got into with my father over the nature of dogs, the reason that's relevant is it's an archetypal struggle that is going on within every dog owner every time they're dealing with an issue with their pet. So the book seems autobiographical, but if the reader reads it carefully, it's not really about my father and I. It's about how emotion works in us and the fear of emotion that we all have, even though our outward personalities may mask that. So what caused me to part company with my father was I had a realization that dogs were completely creatures of the immediate moment. And I developed a way of seeing them and perceiving them and interpreting what they were doing in terms of the immediate moment. And this led me, paradoxically, to a phenomenon that I talk about at length in the book called physical memory. And if we get into the evolution of wolves and what domestication really was, ultimately it boils down to the fact that dogs evolved to go by feel. So what they're doing when they're relating to their owner is really picking up their emotional life history and then acting it out. And that's the end result of my theory and then a career working with hundreds and thousands of dogs and their owners.
So let me get this clear. We have always thought of dogs as that we have to control them, and and there's just there's stories in the book about a story about how you decided to stop controlling your one dog, who you describe at the end of the book, and and when you did that, the dog. And the thing is that the dog would do things that made you feel a certain way. And once you started to feel the feelings instead of thinking that you had to control the dog seemed to grow into who he really was.
I know. It was amazing. Most amazing thing I've ever seen. And what had happened was, you know, I was the son of a famous dog trainer, and I was the best behaved boy in town. And I was proof positive that my father's theory worked. And then I went out and I trained my dogs and I replicated how, even though I was using a completely different theory and a model based on emotional expression and satisfaction, I was still an emotional control freak like my father was. And it just wasn't apparent to me, or it wouldn't have been apparent to anyone talking to me. But I had recreated that. My dog had picked that up. And so I would be really mortified when he would do things that would betray his self-confidence. And I had covered it up with a lot of training, thinking I was building his self-confidence. But ultimately I had that epiphany, and I made a very deep-seated intention to release him from having to be the best-behaved dog in town. And then he just flowered over the course of 3 days. He just expanded into the dog I had always hoped he could be, and he was fat underneath everything all.
Yes, he became, like you said, he expanded into this. That is the key word, where he realized that you had, in your ability to release him, he was able to expand. And, you know, that's what happens to all of us when we let go. It's just a really beautiful thing. But, you make some very interesting comments that I picked up a few of them out of your book, like this one. A dog cannot remember, but it never forgets. Tell us a little bit about that. That's so cool.
Oh, good. Yes. Well, you know, one of the first questions that would arise from an immediate moment, interpretation of behavior, then, you know, how can they remember the past? And not only that, but how is their behavior coherent to other points of view other than their own? And that led me, as I mentioned, to physical memory. And physical memory resides in the body. It's a record of an emotional experience, not a cerebral recording of the event, who did what to who and where and when, but an energetic pattern that's laid down in the body whenever we have a emotional experience. And this needs to be triggered. Our brain, our central nervous system, our higher cognitive functions don't have access to physical memories. And I love computer analogies, because we don't actually have direct access to the physical memories or the physical memory on our hard disk. We need an application to trigger it and bring it to our attention and put it into legible form. And this is what happens in the dog's mind, too. The environment triggers physical memories, and then his brain reconfigures the moment to conform to the physical memory. And then they relive what they had experienced earlier. And so they can never forget, but they can't remember.
Yeah. Like where they bury a bone and stuff like that.
Yeah, you could go away from your dog for 10 years and come back, and it'll instantly recognize you. It might start with a smell. A lot of dogs will be on sight, and then it'll all just flood right back. And so the physical memory is indelible, and unlike mental memory, it's perfect. But it's not formatted according to our rational, intellectual precepts. So this is why we're so... I'm sorry?
There's no time, because there's no linear time in a dog.
Exactly. And it's escaped notice so far because of that. But once you start practicing seeing a dog in terms of the immediate moment, you start to see the logic to it. I liken it to dreams. You know, you can wake up and have a really crazy dream. It doesn't make any sense to you, but then someone knowledgeable about dream logic will start to point out some key features, and then you put your, factor what you felt, what you were experiencing during the dream, and all of a sudden a crystal clear logic comes through. And,
right.
And that's how it is if you want to see dogs in or any animal in terms of the immediate moment, eventually that logic, it just becomes crystal clear. And again, that led me to the premise, your dog is your mirror, because everything he's doing is picking up what's in our physical memory banks, and then his job is to get energy moving. So anything in our in our body mind as a memory is stuck energy, really, and his job is to get it going.
Yes. Which reminds me, was when we got Pearl, I had just started to read your book. That was back in February. And she was very suspicious of me. Now, my husband had driven to Tennessee and brought her back, so she was suspicious of me. And we were lying in bed for the first time together, and I opened my eyes, and there she was looking at me. And I thought, oh, my gosh, your dog is your mirror, but it seemed like I was her mirror, too.
Yeah, well, it's an infinite hall of mirrors.
Yes.
And the important distinction is the dog will never lie. He won't lie to himself. He won't lie to anybody else. This is what I'm feeling, and this is what I have to do.
Yes. And a very interesting idea just came to me about something you said, that the dog is the closest to humans of any animal.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think the human animal is a chimp or an ape or one of our primate first cousins. It is the dog. And I'll tell you, the latest anthropological research is pushing the domestication event of the dog to 30,000, if not later. Mark Dare has even postulated 100,000 years ago. And there's a new article out theorizing that the domestication of the dog is what allowed early hominids to outcompete Neanderthals in Europe. So,
gosh.
And may even be responsible for our human attributes, what makes us distinct from our ancient ancestors.
Oh, my gosh. Now, can you go into a little bit more detail on that?
Yeah, the ability of a dog to follow a human gaze is unparalleled in the animal kingdom, and they've done experiments with raising wolf cubs exactly alongside dogs, puppies, and there's just a distinct divergence that the dog will follow the human gaze, instantly turn to a human when he runs into resistance and solving some kind of problem. But a wolf can't do that, and an ape or monkey can never do it. So this ability to sense a common want, that is fundamental to my understanding of dogs, that they feel what we want, and we feel what they want. And the intersection of those two happens in our heart, and eventually this becomes manifest as some collectivized group activity. So early man and wolf were hunters of a large dangerous prey, And this, I believe, is what brought them together and produced the dog. And I believe, I'm very open to the idea, I think it's the most credible idea, that the co-evolution of dogs with humans gave birth to our very complex feelings, all of which emanate from our heart. And so dog and man are connected heart to heart. And, you know, that just leads into a whole other world of research that's going on into the neuroanatomy of the heart and its faculties of intelligence and memories. It's just the neurochemistry. It's just amazing mm-hmm. things they're finding about the heart. So I believe dog and human go by heart more than by instinct. And what gets us lost in the weeds is we can also, unlike the dog, go by thought. That can tie us up into a knot, and that's when we need our dog to decode us.
Yeah, we become get into ego trips with the dog because of
our
ability.
Yeah, so we get bollocked up in our own daily life, and we think we're feeling something this way or that way, but then our dog will do something that can bring us back to reality if we're willing to pay attention to it and be open to it.
Yeah, so the co-evolution of dogs and humans, that's amazing. And I noticed that I believe it's possible that we mistake a dog's intelligence for their intuition. They're very highly in tune with us. And the more you live with a dog, it's almost like they're I don't know if you've ever seen or heard of course you have, but seen or heard of deer, and it almost feels like a dream.
A herd of deer?
Yeah, like a herd of deer feels like a dream.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean,
It's like they're etheric beings and stuff, and the dog reminds me of that. I mean, I know when I take any of my dogs for a walk in nature, they become so much more of who they are, and they just get this lovely way about them. And I mean, my other dog Ulysses did not like other dogs, so it wasn't so much fun to run into other dogs. I guess maybe there was something within myself that had made that happen.
When energy gets stuck, it can come out as an explosion, or it can be re-internalized as an implosion. And we have a lot of denial about aggression these days, and that's why we're getting more and more aggressive dogs. You'll find a lot of very peaceful people will have an aggressive dog, and they'll seek to rescue an aggressive dog so that they mm-hmm. can there's a part of them that wants to explore the role that aggression's supposed to play. And I want to emphasize that it's a healthful role. The example I give is our immune system is incredibly aggressive. It's got macrophages, leukocytes, killer T cells, and it preserves the integrity of the organism. So aggression's a good thing. If we didn't have aggressive immune systems, we would be dead in about 10 minutes. So there's a huge judgment against aggression these days, which is why we're getting more and more aggressive dogs.
Well, that's fascinating. It really is. However, Pearl is not, thankfully, is not aggressive at all. She's sitting here looking at me now. She came kind of, I just made sure that she had a lot of exercise before this program so that she wouldn't, you know, become mm-hmm. energetic because she's a puppy. But she just sort of came over and she's looking at me. She's very relaxed. And I would say that she is a dog who really learns quickly. Picks up on what she needs to do. She's a survivor because of being out in the wild like that.
Right.
And she you become so close to these animals, and they don't live that long. You know, it's kind of scary how short of the life they live. But I guess you need to look at it in a different way, because in that short amount of time, you really do touch eternity with them. You get into their time with them. And that's such a helpful to us.
Right, right.
Now, you had talked about the animal mind and the nature of learning. Now, it seems that that the emotional, the seat of the emotions is in the gut, in the solar plexus. And you do talk about that a little bit. And that is a seat of intuition. And I think that maybe we are, well, we are related to our dogs in a heart-to-heart way, but it seems like it's not in the brain, as you had said earlier.
Right. Yeah. What I discovered was that emotion, and this is becoming common thinking at right now these days as well, but emotion is a universal force of attraction. And if you interpret it in terms of the immediate moment, you quickly discover that it acts like an energy, so that we become emotionally charged. We act, and dogs, will, if you watch them acting out and interacting, I should say, they act as if they're charged particles of magnetism and electricity. And the reason this is adaptive, if we go to evolution for a moment, is they predict where energy is going to be. They can feel where energy is going to be. For example, if two dogs are playing, you start to see one dog predict and intercept him on a circle. And, yeah, and then and that's a template for absolutely everything they're doing. It, you know, a lot of dogs will know when you're going on a trip before you know you're going on a trip.
And
there's really neat neuroscience going on now where they've discovered that a part of your brain lights up when you've arrived at a decision, but sometimes up to 9 seconds before you become consciously aware of the decision you've just made. And in my experiences, I've had dogs act in that precursor to my acting, or a client before they would act, the dog would already anticipate that and go into position. And, you know, it's just an amazing faculty. So what they're doing is reading our emotional conductivity.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, when they really get patterned to us, they can predict what we're about to do before we do it. And this can elaborate into when we talk of intuition. I mean, it can just elaborate way up into the spiritual stratosphere with the ability to navigate and find an owner they've been separated from, and then the owner moved across the country.
Right.
That's an amazing story. A guy was out camping with his dog in the Southwest, and the dog got separated. They went out and chased something, and he couldn't find his dog. He hung around for weeks, but he finally had to go back home to the East Coast. And he got transferred. He got a new job out in Oregon or the Northwest. And a couple of years later, who shows up in his backyard but his dog?
Oh, that is amazing.
Yeah, it's, did he know where he was? So I could tell you stories about my own dogs, but one of my clients' dogs, it was, I used to have a boarding grooming kennel, training boarding grooming. One of the grooming dogs got away from their owner at their home and hopped on the back of a truck and ended up in Ohio from New York State. And the truck driver called up the people, found the tag on the dog, and was going to leave it at a vet, a local vet in Ohio, and the people were going to drive out and pick up Maxine, or the dog's name was. But she bolted out of the cab of the truck and got away from the trucker. And that was the end of that, apparently. And about 6 months later, they let in the Font, the dog that they got from me. He comes in from the backyard, and right behind him was Maxine, this little gray cockapoo who, I mean, she's matted and starving, but none the worse for wear. She just walked in the back door like she always did. So somehow she navigated from Ohio to the Northeast, New York State, right near the coast, and she made it all that way. So,
now, is that just done on pure intuition?
Yeah, I think
there's some sort of coding.
If you want me to get really theoretical, I think we displace, we have an emotional mass. This is that physical memory, and it displaces the time-space continuum, and the dog can feel that. If he's not too, I believe if he's not too frightened, and not too friendly. So most dogs will get hungry, and after about 20, 30 miles, they're eventually just going to glom onto some family and come in for a landing. And some dogs are going to be so frightened, they're going to be afraid of everything and just hide out and probably won't come to a good end. But certain dogs I've noticed, the ones I've known that have done this, have been just the right balance. They're not real, real friendly, but they're not real afraid either. So they just keep on the move. They don't quite glom on to anybody, but they get food along the way, and they keep moving. And I believe at that level of attunement, I think every dog can do it, but this one temperament type will just stay attuned and just keep going, and he can feel that pull. You know, it's like the Fijians outrigger canoeists. They can go 500 miles and just hit a postage stamp atoll, and they can just feel where they're going to go. And in the settlement of America, there were frontiersmen who could be dropped off anywhere. And they knew how to go in a straight line anywhere they wanted to go. And
so every
animal, and humans included, have a little piece of magnetite in our inner ear canal. And there's no known reason for that. But I think we all retain, that's part of the physical appendage, part of our intuition. So we could attune ourselves to the Earth's magnetic field, and we could attune ourselves to where our owner might be vibing in on that frequency, too. So it's just unbelievable what animals are capable of. I think we're just starting to opening up to the mysteries of the animal mind. And my mission is to point out that the things we think are mundane, sitting for a cookie, and the dogs do things for reinforcement, the operant conditioning model, that they don't actually make sense, that something far more magical is going on underneath all that. If we were to look at it again in terms of the immediate moment, and I think I've pretty successfully articulated a model that can begin to let the owner know what the logic is and how to see it and how to start working with it and playing with it.
So are you teaching this model or using it with
With all my clients that I work with, I teach them what's going on inside their dog's mind, the very basic, most basic architecture that, by the way, all animals have it, but it's most pronounced in the dog. He goes by the most primordial architecture of the animal mind than any other species of animal, because it's how we resonate with things that aren't genetically like us. So, for example, the internet is populated by millions and if not billions of computers, different operating systems, different makes, manufacturers, software capabilities, and yet they're all communicating according to a common protocol.
And that's
what's going on in nature as well, I believe.
And
that same protocol we can divine in the dog because he's living with us according to that most basic makeup of the animal mind. So, you know, if you hang out with a fox, we're so overwhelming to them that we're not going to see, they're not going to be able to apply that basic, the most basic vulnerable part of their mind. They won't be able to display it near us very well. And we distort what they do just by our sheer presence. It's sort of like the physicist looks at a photon or electron and he changes its value and he can't see it. He can't know the location and the momentum at the same time. But the dog is the dog even when he's with us because he evolved in simpatico with us. So,
yes.
Yeah, I can remember in the 80s, everybody was saying, well, gorillas in the mist, you had to go to these remote foreign jungles, exotic lands to study animals in their wild habitat to really understand an animal. And I remember laughing to myself or smiling to myself, saying, no, you don't. It's right here. It's right by the, curled up by the fire. It's right at your feet. That's the animal mind laid bare.
They are the closest to us because they've been with us for so long. That's so interesting. Oh, my gosh. I love it.
Yeah, and they bring out our animal mind to the surface. So we can really get in tune with the way our emotion works by not projecting our thoughts and our values, our moral precepts and our intellectual constructs onto their mind. And that's a skill. So hopefully my books are beginning to make that possible for people to start learning how to do that.
Yeah, you say dogs are never wrong. And I think that with all the recent stuff that's going on with natural disasters and the way dogs, all the animals seem to know when to escape in exactly the right moment, and the human beings are just sort of got, you know, lollygagging, taking pictures of disasters and getting swept away.
Well, yeah, actually, and you know, just to repeat, we do have that latent capacity ourselves. I remember after the 2004 tsunami, there were some modern Thai fishermen fishing in some area, and they were next to an indigenous peoples, an island dwellers who were fishing alongside them, and they started saying, "Hey guys, the water doesn't look right. The color is wrong. You gotta get out of here." And they laughed at them. They ignored them, and they hightailed it back to the village and then head for high ground. And then after the debacle, they feared the. Experts feared that this village had been, this islanders had been wiped out, and they went over and they all were fine. They knew it was coming. They could just see the color of the water. And
that's amazing, yeah.
And the Fijian outriggers, again, when they put their paddle in the water, they know how deep it is just by the feel of the water.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we magnify that by 100. That's probably approaching what an animal can do.
Well, if you are in tune with your animals and you know that they are never wrong, and you can just sense what's going on if a storm is coming, or I can always tell when my husband's coming home, by the way, our dogs.
Well, that's true, yeah.
And, I mean, you can tell everything if you're tuned into them.
Mm-hmm.
And don't act like humans are superior to the animals, because they're not.
That's right.
So, and there are other ways that the dog is never wrong. So you had talked about how they can sense in people different, there's a crime about to occur.
Yeah, I had that's what actually opened me up to the concept in the first place, was I was selling protection dogs and police dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd get these reports of a dog had jumped, one man I write about, his dog, his protection dog he bought from me, and he jumped up on his partner, knocked him down, and pinned him to the ground. He didn't bite him, but he was whining.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so we were going to get together and resolve that. This was the guy's partner, and the dog had to be civil around him. And he called me back and said, never mind. He had hired a private investigator to check out his background. They were going into a restaurant together and posting a big amount of cash to put up the liquor license, and the guy was coming to pick up the check from this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And his dog could feel he was going to steal it, but the guy wasn't hitting Jim over the head to take his money, but he was going to steal from Jim, and that was the whine. He wanted to bite him, but he wasn't giving him a real good reason to do it. So I had that happen with my own dog too. He grabbed a guy and whined. He wouldn't bite him, he just whined. And turned out the same kind of thing was going on.
Wow.
And then cops would always tell me the dog would go on the job the first day on the job, and he'd pick out a known criminal from the backseat of the cruiser in a mob of people, and he'd just pick him out, and the cop's jaw would drop because he just couldn't understand how this dog could sense that was the one guy who was a serious criminal in that whole group of people gathered together. So, I mean, the stories are just unbelievable. That's why I coined the expression, dogs are never wrong.
Yeah, they aren't.
They really never are. Yeah.
No. You probably have a million stories.
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, and it seems like at the basis of it all, if we are serious about healing ourselves, you know, self-healing, and our dogs will be very grateful for that, because it will release them. Be more themselves.
Exactly. So what I tell my clients is to forget about the dog, that the owner and the dog, the dog's mind is part of an energy circuit, an emotional connection with whatever he's attracted to. So it's all one loop. And I tell my clients to look at the dog as a reflection. And that's what releases the dog. Whereas a lot of what's going on today, one of the reasons for all the aggression is people feel very guilty about their dogs, and they're not doing enough, and they should mentally stimulate them more and give them more exercise. And they're not seeing the dog as a part of their own mind.
Yeah.
And to learn how to become comfortable with that rather than being guilty.
Right. Well, obviously, if you think you have to walk your dog and do all these things for your dog and stimulate them and teach them tricks, that's a good one.
Right.
That you're not seeing them as an equal.
Well,
the whole idea of
the idea of equal and superior, is throws us off track. They're just one with us.
But
having said that, we have the most emotional mass. It doesn't make us better, but we are the ones with the most unresolved emotion in our systems because we're human beings. We're really high capacity, and we've been alive. We're going to live a lot longer, so we're going to acquire a lot more mass, or what some people would call gravitas. And we displace the time-space continuum a lot more than a dog does. So what we have to do is learn how to exercise our will with the dog in terms of how emotion works, and that benefits the dog and the owner.
So
it isn't one relative to another and trying to work out equality, because that misses the flow by which emotion works as well. You have to just go by how emotion flows. You and your dog are creating an emotional circuit, and it must flow one to the other. And then we're applying this flow pattern to a really artificial, highly constrained environment, i.e. our house and our social network, and then taking the dog to town, and he's got to get vetted. So we can't ask the dog, who lives in the immediate moment, to show us the way. We have to, this is the point of training. We have to have the most will. We lead, the dog is happy to follow, but it's got to work according to the natural architecture by which emotion works, which is why I wrote my first book, Natural Dog Training, which describes how the dog's mind works in terms of the practical day-to-day realities of living with a dog.
Oh, my, that sounds good. That's actually a good one.
Yep.
Okay, so that helps me. I have to tell you that... instead of, dropping the judgments and dropping the assumptions and dropping all these expectations and all this and that you have with your dog, you basically just get into a flow with that.
Exactly,
and,
you have to feel the flow, be in the moment, and then when your physical memory comes up and what the things that your dog does, you have to learn to see it.
Yes.
So, like, if you have a, that's why I put my own story in there with my dogs, is when my dog's fear would come to the surface, stuff that I thought I had resolved, I had to learn to see that's what it was. I was able to do that because of working with customers. It's just so obvious what the dog was revealing about my clients. So... at some point, I realized, wow, if it's true for them, it must be true for me. And then, bam, that's when it hit me.
Right. You thought you had to have a perfect dog because you were the authority.
Yeah, I wanted to be super trainer. But as it turns out, once you know your dog is your reflection and you get more comfortable with that, then your dog manifests really, really amazing capacities. And you don't have to be perfect to have a great dog. And you don't have to be dominant. You don't have to be an amazingly loving person. You just have to be you.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to be you, and your dog will be happy to be with you.
Oh, yeah. They will. The puppy stage is especially trying, I'd say.
Well, what's interesting, natural dog training, it isn't, because we just go at the level that the dog can go at. We don't go any farther than that. And we don't ask the dog to act, the puppy to act like an adult. In natural dog training, the more the puppy that makes it into adulthood, the happier the dog, the more self-confident the dog. So what we're working toward is preserving that, I've been talking about this primal architecture, this very basic emotional dynamic, And it doesn't survive into adulthood on its own. It has to be nurtured. And it goes against a lot of our human civilization, all the strictures that living in a contentious society will impose upon us. And so when you raise your puppy, my theory, as I lay it out in the book, is that there's only two animals that are truly domesticated. And by that I mean they're expected to subordinate every impulse to fit into human society, and those two animals are dogs, because, you know, we don't expect the horse to be house trained in our house. We leave them behind the barn. We don't expect our cat to not be a hunter if they're so inclined. It's the dog and human babies.
Little babies, yeah.
Human babies.
That's fascinating.
Oh, good. So as we raise a puppy, I believe that we're unconsciously triggered, our physical memories of how we were raised and domesticated to become part of human civilization. We have to confront them all over again. We have to re-experience them. So my hope is that if you see it in those terms, when we're raising a puppy, we'll become more conscious of all these judgments that are going to come up. Well, the puppy should do this, the puppy should be this way and that way, when in reality we want to work with our dog's nature and shape it according to its ways rather than impose our judgments and moral systems on it.
Yes.
So it's the way I raise a puppy is very low work, but we never let the puppy make a mistake because we put him in a prescribed situation, and the highlight of his life is going to be hiking in the woods and doing very natural things. And that is how we do the bonding part. And once you get that bond, then the training just falls into place for them.
Well, I've noticed that with Pearl. I mean, we go for long walks, because I enjoy watching her in the outdoors, it's just such a beautiful experience because she's so happy. And as a result of these walks, we have bonded.
Yeah, it's the best thing you can do with your dog. And this is the one that you've rescued from Tennessee, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the best thing you can do is take them out into the woods, play hide and seek, and just relax. Because, you know, when we're in the woods, that we're in the moment.
Yes.
Nature decompresses us, and our mind, we instantly relax and attune, and you just kind of lose track of all this stuff. So that's where the dog wants to be with the owner. So anyhow, that's the major thing we can do for bonding, rather than taking them to early imprinting classes and teaching them all these skill sets. So that's not the most important thing to do. The most important thing to do is to get as much of that puppy into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually true of police dogs. This is where I came up with the premise, was working with the police dogs. The strongest ones who fought the criminal the hardest and who were the most reliable with kids and cats and civilians.
Yeah.
They had this puppy quality when they were doing the work. They were deadly serious when appropriate, but they had a puppiness to them that was this whole body sensuality and a playfulness.
Yeah.
And they retained that into adulthood. And those were the best dogs. So I started modeling raising a puppy in that way. So
yeah.
The more spontaneous and yabba dabba doo made it into adulthood, it always worked out best.
Yeah, that is a very interesting theory. Pearl.
There you go.
Yeah.
You must be hearing the thunderstorm we're having.
Where are you located?
I'm in Vermont. And we're having a big boomer going on right now.
So she might be hearing that from where
that's
I'm
right.
Yeah, that's right.
Hearing a crackling
right.
on the telephone lines.
So you make a statement in your book that says, use your dog to return to a state of animal consciousness, which
right.
is what those walks do. You know,
exactly, yeah.
The walk. And you want your dog to come to you. But so I think this hide-and-seek stuff in the woods is a natural way to teach them to come to you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
See, inside the dog is a magnet. like we've alluded to that earlier. So if you take the young puppy and you go out into the middle of a big wide open space and you walk left, your puppy will be right behind you. You go right, the puppy will be right there. No matter where you go, he's following you. But what happens over the course of his, as he grows up, is that magnet gets dulled. People don't use it appropriately. They don't strengthen it. So something else starts to capture the dog's magnetic feelings of the deer and the rabbit or other dogs on the horizon. And the owner didn't keep working on keeping the magnetic connection between them at full capacity.
So
when you go in the woods, your dog is going to be really magnetically attuned to you. And all you got to do is run away a little bit, and he's going to come flying to you. And if he goes around the trail, you can hide. And then within minutes, he'll be, like, eating up the woods looking for you. And I make it very structured. I'll take someone with me, and we'll play hide-and-seek. And we basically develop it into a basic search and rescue kind of routine so that he's looking for the owner. I'll go in a trail from one direction once the dog is qualified, and the owner will hide. We know which way the wind's going, and I'll do a search of the woods. So the dog is hunting for his owner. And they're
now part of
a working group, a team, and this really cultivates this group ethic between dog and owner.
Yes.
Rather than letting the dog's instincts take over and he starts saying, wow, when I'm around humans, I can't be magnetic. I gotta hold myself back. And then the rabbits and the dogs and the deer start to become overwhelmingly attractive. He just can't resist that magnet pulling him. Because, you know, if we were another dog, we would be joining him in all this stuff. We'd be chasing right alongside him. We wouldn't be asking him to stay with us. We'd be with him. He said, great, let's get that deer. Let's chase it. That's fun. So we'd be digging and rolling and, you know, doing all the things that dogs do. We'd be going fast like he does. So, we can't do all that, but the dog can feel as if you are doing that if you're very careful when he's a puppy and not violate that magnet. You can think of the magnet. I love the Mac computers where they have a magnet that connects the electrical charging device now. You plug your...
Yes.
So, you know, and it's a great idea. So if you walk into the cord, you don't pull the laptop onto the floor.
Right.
But I love that because that magnetic connection between the wall and the computer allows the juice to flow. And notice that we use electricity and emotion. We both say the juices are flowing. Like in a battery.
Yeah.
Yes, we use the same. Intuitively, everything I'm saying is already in our language. But at any rate, so that connection that gets the dog glommed onto you so that the emotion as electricity can flow between you, that's a magnet. And that magnet has to be amplified and strengthened as the rigors of the world come into the dog's life and not dull it. So I don't believe in any corrections in the early house training and teaching a dog all those rules. I just use these judicious use of a crate, kennels, fenced yards, long leashes, so the dog never makes a mistake, and he grows up to be the happiest dog in the world.
Oh, that's beautiful. So this whole obedience training thing, first of all, it has traditionally been very punitive.
Right.
And now there's more of an evolution towards people, you know, being less punitive in obedience training. But I do think that even if it's called obedience training, it somehow is missing the mark by that word.
Yeah. I mean, the modern dog training industry is bifurcated into two distinct camps. There's the dominance, so-called punitive method, and we see that with Cesar Millan on TV. And then you have the positive operant conditioning, clicker training, which I think is highly elaborate trick training. It doesn't address the core of what's going on between dog and human. They're not learning machines that need to be treated into and lured into where we want them. There's an innate mechanism. There's this magnet that connects us, and then the current can flow. And this is what's really shaping their development, and that's what we should focus on. So I believe it's a false dichotomy, and the way I sum up the conundrum that the dog owner has faced is you have Cesar Millan saying order is everything, and I call that order for the sake of order. Meanwhile, on the positive, they're saying flow is everything. Flow, flow, flow. So my resolution of the paradox is the purpose of order is flow, but you can't have flow without order.
Right.
And
well,
that takes the moral judgment
out
of the equation.
Kind of reminds me, it does, and it reminds me of even a flock of geese flying in their beautiful formations. But that is really what a dog does for us, you know, if we allow it to happen.
That's right. And again, that's a function of the energy. My expression is the information is in the energy. So if there is emotion flowing between dog and owner, it will guide the dog into alignment with us and into a state of synchronization with us. And he is getting these commands, do this and do that, innately. They're coming from within him, what I call temperament, or the better word for temperament is heart. And he's privy to this internal language that's commanding him. And what I teach people to do is to couple their commands with that internal voice, if you will, that he's already hearing. So
mm-hmm.
our words should amplify the signal that he innately picks up anyhow. And
mm-hmm.
and that's how we can learn to play with that energy and that flow of emotion so that it informs the dog. It doesn't just animate, it informs.
Mm-hmm. Because they're so tuned in to us.
Right. Well, you know, now all animals are tuned in, but they don't have a strong enough magnet to connect. So every animal is attracted to humans. And in rare instances, you know, in special circumstances, you'll get these amazing bonds between humans and animals of all kinds, lions, elephants.
Of course,
yeah. But only the dog can do it indirectly in our own, in our life, in our civilization, can fully engage with us. And again, that's because of this magnet. So, you know, I mentioned earlier about where the human points. Only the dog really attunes to that. And our hand and our gaze becomes, in their minds, so that our dogs, it's like a needle pointing to the north.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that magnet deflecting them onto a common orientation with humans.
The
and only the dog can do it. Yeah, so
if we look
in a direction, I mean, I do this with my dog all the time. I'm driving my tractor. I'm going into the woods to get stuff, and I'll drop something off the tractor, and I'll just point at it, and the dogs will just pick it up, and they jump up on the tire, and they give it to me. And I did that all without training. I never actually
mm-hmm.
officially trained them to do that, but it's just something dogs do. It's very easy to get them to do it. You point at it, you get them all excited, and they get frustrated, and sooner they track where your finger's pointing right to the object. They pick it up, and then you got to do a little training so that they want to give it to you. But that's just part of how you play with them. And they'll jump right up on the top of my tractor tire. They're right off the ground, and they put it right in my hand. And then I throw it in the bucket, and we go on our way. And that's a function of, you know, magnetic energy deflects a particle along a line of force. So our hands become an extension of our energy, and it directs
mm-hmm.
the dog, just like a magnet would deflect something onto a new line of force. That's why dogs follow our gaze and where we point, because of that magnetic attunement to us.
Oh, that's fascinating. It really is. I'm going to say something here. The wolf. I wanted to talk a little bit about the wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever hung around with a wolf?
Not too much. I mean, I've gone to a couple of wolf demonstrations, and I went to the Yukon had a wolf breeding, canine breeding with dingoes and foxes and coyotes years ago. I went there.
Mm-hmm.
So I will tell you though, I have a highly developed theories of the wolf, and I think I'm qualified to have such a theory because of my career as a protection dog trainer, and.
Uh-huh.
In effect, I was the moose. I was the prey, and I was communicating with the police dog or protection dog just as moose and wolf interplay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that gives me a lot of insight into what's going on in a wolf's mind when he's doing the things he's doing.
Yeah. Well, we had a friend who had two wolves, and basically they, you know, underplayed it so that they didn't want people. I mean, it was obvious that they were wolves, but on the other hand, if you said that they were a Malamute, or they called
right.
it something else, so people didn't know that they were wolves. So one time they brought these wolves to our house, and we were sitting outside, and the one wolf they both disappeared, and it was like, where are they? And they were actually hidden from us, and we found them, and they were digging a hole. So they dug a hole like 30 feet so fast, you know, trying to get to a groundhog. And
right.
and they weren't paying any attention to us at all. I mean, they were not really linked to us. Now, they really, their humans were very much in love with them, but it's almost like it was a whole different feel than hanging out with a dog.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's a good point. You can make that distinction. They may be tamed, but they're not domesticated.
Yeah, that was not, all of a sudden, at the sleight of hand, they were off to being completely wild.
Right. I'm not a big fan of people owning wolves. I really think they should be admired from afar and not contained, we can't try to possess them.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a big fan of that. I think we should. The dog and a wolf is the dog is the heart of the wolf.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah.
And wolves are amazing, and they have highly developed instincts. But the dog evolved away from that. He evolved to go by feel and with less instincts. They're still there, but they're very muted and not developed. I believe they are still there. But they're very atrophied, so to speak, and that makes it possible for the dog to be a completely emotional being amongst us. And that's what we should be striving for, not to try to snatch our own little piece of wilderness and live with it. I think that kind of destroys it. I think we should master what dogs are here to show us. That's the highest aspiration, I would say.
Yeah, beautiful. And the fact that they're not as don't have the instincts, they're more feeling creatures and they're more in tune with humans than a wolf certainly is.
Right.
I just love the whole idea. I mean, it has helped me. Talking to you has really helped me with Pearl because she is a puppy, and I realized that the more I let her go, and I have. Done this just with not even reading your book, but I have been reading your book now for a few months, and it's just a beautiful thing to think that our dog can teach us so much.
Right.
Certainly, I've known that with our other dogs, and they're just amazing. I mean, how do you feel about having more than one dog? Have you ever had a pack of dogs that you live with?
I'm a one dog man. I don't like a lot of social chaos and tumult.
Mm-hmm.
So personally, I'm a one dog man. I think it's hard to get a level of rapport, a working rapport with more than one dog. I mean, but some
mm-hmm.
people are well suited for it. They have a very gregarious nature, so they may do very well. You know, I'm sure they do very well with more than one dog, but. If you get too many, I think they become doggy, and the human doesn't quite fit as cleanly with all of them as they could. You know, they're all going to love the owner. There's no question about that. But to get a level of rapport with each one, I say it's I like to use exponential factors. So if you have two dogs, it's two times two. If you have three dogs, three times three times three. And then they start feeding off each other, and it just makes for in my mind, a lot of chaos. I like, I always have more than, I always have two or three dogs, but I am a one dog man.
A one dog man.
Yep.
Well, we've come to the end of our hour, and this has been really enlightening for me. I appreciate it. We've had a few people listening in, and I will be passing it around. So
excellent.
I really appreciate it. I really, really appreciate it. So I'll be following.
It's my pleasure. I'm so happy that you got so much out of my books.
Oh, thank you. And I will be I signed up to your list, and I'll be getting your newsletter and so forth. So thank you so much again, and have a wonderful, beautiful evening and the thunderstorms.
Yes, well, I enjoy them, so that's fine.
Me too.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.